Salo for Lover, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susanna Suisuki. Coming up, a date's been set for the election of Solomon Islands Prime Minister. Also,
it's not enough to just have any kind of job. What is, of course, also really important is the quality of that job.
Concerns linger as the Pacific struggles to bring down the number of unemployed youth. And
I don't believe that there is enough in place to protect the state.
A Cook Islands ocean advocate urges the public to save its coral reefs. In Solomon Islands, a date has now been set for the election of the country's prime minister. This is after no clear winner emerged from the national election, with two main coalition groupings now lobbying for support to govern in the capital, Honiara. Kuroi Hawkins has been following developments and joins me now.
So the Governor-General has set the date for 9:30 a.m. local time on Thursday. That's this Thursday, the 2nd of May, and it will be held at Parliament. This information was relayed in a notice from the Governor-General, Sir David Vunagi, to MPs in the capital, Honiara, today. We've seen a signed copy of the notice, and it states that there's also a 24-hour nomination period for prime ministerial candidates, which opened at 10 a.m. on Monday and will close at 4 p.m. Tuesday. So all members of parliament are eligible to be nominated. This must be done by four of their fellow MPs putting them up for the candidacy. They can withdraw their candidature at any time before the conclusion of the election. The voting is presided over by the Governor General in parliament, and it's carried out by secret ballot.
Now, there are two main coalition groupings lobbying to form government. Who are they, and is there a clear front runner?
Yeah, so the two groupings that have sort of emerged are loosely sort of formed around the former government and former opposition grouping that we had coming out of the last parliament and going into the election. So on one hand, you have the caretaker Prime Minister Manasseh Songovare's Our Party, which emerged from the election with 15 MPs. They've been joined by the People's First Party, who secured three seats, but now they claim to have added several independent MPs to their roster, and the Kandere Party, which has one MP. So Mr. Songovare also claims to have the support of several shadow MPs who ran as independents but are affiliated to Our Party. So that's one grouping. On the other side, you have the former leader of the opposition, Matthew Wale's Democratic Party, which secured 11 seats in the election, teaming up with Peter Kenilorea Jr.'s United Party, who won six seats in the election, but also claimed to have persuaded some independent MPs to join their ranks post-election. So they're joined by two other single MP parties, Yumi for Change and the Democratic Alliance Party. So looking at the numbers, on paper, without the independent factor, the Matthew Wale Peter Kenilorea camp should have one member more, but with the independents in line, Our Party or the caretaker Prime Minister Manasseh Songovare's party are claiming to have the majority. So with the election of the Prime Minister now set, a date now set, all of that will come to the fore, and we'll see once they get in. A wild card in the lobbying process, though, this election is the charismatic former Prime Minister Gordon Darcy Lilo, who's staged a massive political comeback to come back after two terms outside of parliament. And so he's sort of a wild card sitting outside of the main two blocks. So if he manages to pull a few MPs his way, he might form a kingmaker bloc. So interesting dynamics, Sana.
There's a large regional security presence in the capital, Honiara. Why is this necessary for an election in a sovereign country?
Politics in Solomon Islands is always quite fraught, especially when it comes to the election of the Prime Minister. The voting process and the election of the MPs themselves is quite transparent, and it's quite open and accountable. But when it comes to this period, which is where the MPs themselves gather and decide on who to become Prime Minister, that is where a lot of people get quite frustrated with the process. And if a person or a candidate for prime minister succeeds and is not well liked by the general population, there's usually a lot of unrest, political unrest, spills over into public unrest. And the city, the Honiara city, is just a sprawling expanse of settlements and formal housing. So there's a lot of unemployment, there's a lot of youth unemployment, and a lot of opportunists sort of coming off the back of political unrest. And it snowballs into these massive riots that often happen in the capital. The most recent was actually in 2021, and that just came out of a protest against the government that spiraled into riots that burned half of the town. So there's a massive presence in the country of regional police forces supporting the local police force to try and make sure that the election of the prime minister and the formation of government goes peacefully. A liquor ban has also been extended out until the 15th of May. It's been in place for the election, and that's also been a little unpopular with local businesses and locals, but a liquor ban is also in place for this period.
High rates of youth unemployment in parts of the Pacific continue to be of concern, according to a new International Labour Organization report. It's not just unemployment. The share of young people who are not in education or training is at staggering levels in some parts of the region. The ILO report highlights low wages, lack of opportunity, and high levels of informal employment persist despite resilient job growth. The chief author of the report, Christian Vigalan, says despite strong job markets, concerns linger.
For example, what we do continue to observe throughout actually all Pacific Island countries is that especially young people, youth, they have very often difficulties finding a job domestically. So youth unemployment is consistently higher across all countries for which we do have data than the unemployment rates for adults.
Mr. Vigalan says the lack of quality jobs is also an issue in the region.
It's not enough to just have any kind of job. So what is, of course, also really important is the quality of that job. We do often see in this region, especially in the smaller Pacific Island countries, jobs of poor quality. So, for example, compared to Australia and New Zealand, we also continue to see quite a substantial share of people that are in employment, but actually don't earn enough to actually escape poverty.
Informal employment also comes up in the report. That's any type of activity that is not covered by any laws, including labour legislation or social protection. Christian Vigalan says across most countries, women are more represented in that pool of informal workers.
The high informal employment rate, wage gaps, gender wage gaps, and also in many countries, persistently higher unemployment rates among women compared to men. This does remain also a concern in the Pacific.
Mr. Vigalan says these are big challenges countries are facing, but he says changes can be made to address these issues.
When countries really commit to some change, commit to some policies, and when I say countries, I mean really also governments and at the highest level, then I think it is realistically actually possible to do some change.
Christian Vigalan says to bring on board donor partners, the Pacific Islands Forum and organizations like the ILO could also help form solutions that can make concrete changes. An environmental advocate is calling for better protection of coral reefs in the Cook Islands. Alex King has founded an NGO to save corals across the country and raise awareness on issues affecting ocean health. Tiana Haxton spoke to Alex King to learn more.
Raised in Rarotonga for most of her life, Alex King has witnessed how climate change, pollution and overfishing has affected the island's reefs. She says certain industries can also be harmful to Rarotonga's ocean.
There's many different things that affect our coral reef, but I think the most direct one that's kind of being swept under the carpet a little bit is our tourism industry. As much as we love and enjoy having our visitors and those that support our businesses locally, we also need to focus on and that environmental management.
Over the years, King has advocated for tour operators and tourists alike to be more mindful of live corals. She says stepping on coral and even certain sunscreens can cause severe harm to coral, and people need to be more aware of the important role coral systems play in the ecosystem and the lives of Cook Islanders.
Because we're an ocean community, we also use that base as one of our main resources, our main food sources. I don't believe that there is enough in place to protect the space.
While King calls for better legal measurements to protect coral systems in the Cook Islands, she has taken it upon herself to jump into action. Through her NGO, Te Aro Te Ako, she spent the past year setting up a coral nursery to save broken coral fragments and regrow them.
The purpose of this is to help reintroduce better reef management, to help increase marine life, coral cover, also marine stewardship within the local community.
She grew a large team of volunteers who frequently dive to collect coral fragments and attach them to submerged frames where their growth is monitored over time. A second nursery is currently under construction and there is interest in branching out beyond the main island.
We are looking at expanding in Sapa'inoa to other outer islands, which is a really positive step, especially for outer island communities who are really interested in taking part and doing their part in managing their reef.
King hopes her project helps the community to recognise the importance of coral reefs in the island nation's ecosystem. She looks forward to another busy year growing corals and encourage more of her community to be environmentally friendly.
The United Nations Development Programme and Japan have launched an innovation hub in Buka and Bougainville. The autonomous Papua New Guinea region is striving to develop its economy as it seeks independence, and the hub will have a role to play by boosting entrepreneurship and digital literacy. The UNDP's resident representative, Nicholas Booth, told Don Wiseman the hub will have a particular focus on women and youth.
The innovation hub is a space where entrepreneurs, especially women entrepreneurs and young entrepreneurs, can come together. We can help incubate them because basically it's a space that provides access to the internet. It provides computers and internet connections. It provides a meeting space. It provides access to power, which is an important thing in a country where only 18% of the country is connected to the grid. It's solar powered. It's going to be connected to power the whole time. There's a space for the local woman political leader to be there. So there's a space to be able to connect with local politicians. There are going to be spaces for banks. And basically, this is how we hope to help incubate the successful businesses of Bougainville's future.
Will there be mentors there, or are these people going to be left on their own?
Yes, there are going to be mentors. And I should say these innovation hubs, they're part of a larger project. I mean, we've already trained over 300 people. More than 80% of them are women. I think 15% of them have been under the age of 24. So a real focus on training the future women and young entrepreneurs of Bougainville. And we've developed a training course for them that we've administered. And it's actually won awards. It won the Australian Innovation Award because it was a training course that was really developed, you know, in consultation with people in Bougainville, with entrepreneurs in Bougainville, and reflecting their needs and the innovative nature of has been recognised. They got the Australian Good Design Award last year. We were very proud of that. So that training we've been doing since the end of 2022. So the training and the mentorship are an integral part of it. But of course, you know, business thrives on connection. Innovation and entrepreneurship thrive on connection. So we also need to be able to provide these entrepreneurs with access to the internet, access to power, access to finance, and access to connect with each other. And in Bougainville, as elsewhere, you know, those kind of spaces to meet and access are not really often available. Yes. And they're absolutely critical to getting a business going.
Access to finance has to be the big factor for entrepreneurs, I would imagine, particularly in a place like Bougainville, where I don't think there's a great deal of wealth within the community. So when you say there's access to finance, what do you mean?
Right. Well, so that's why an important part of our partnership is with our sister agency, the UN Capital Development Fund. That's the entity in the UN system that really specializes in providing access to finance. It's got special rules and regulations that the rest of us don't have. It's an expert in providing access to microfinance. One of the big problems, Don, I'm sure you're aware, across PNG and Bougainville as well, is that the cost of capital is extraordinarily high. I mean, very often prohibitively expensive. You know, interest rates can be up in the 30% and so on. And we work, and the UNCDF in particular works with microfinance institutions to bring the cost of capital down and make it easier. So, I mean, on the one hand, CDF is an expert in training entrepreneurs, in strengthening their financial literacy. So there's that part too. There's a capacity building and training part in helping startup businesses just strengthen their muscle, their financial muscle, their bookkeeping muscle, and increase their financial literacy. But we also have to help them get access to capital. And that's what, in partnership with UNCDF, we hope to be able to do. We work in particular with the National Development Bank and with the Women's Microbank Limited, known as Mama Bank. And I think we're also going to provide spaces. So I think, you know, National Development Bank has told us they actually would like to open branches actually at our innovation hubs that will enable them to have a presence in Bougainville that they didn't have before.
What sort of idea have you getting of success so far?
Look, the hubs opened last week. We've been working with young entrepreneurs, a whole range of them across Bougainville for a while, and they've been great successes. I don't have time to go through them all with you individually. But for example, I mean, I was very excited to meet one of our award-winning entrepreneurs. She herself was excellent at making baskets, which are a particular well-known craft in Bougainville. And she actually saw that there was great potential for these baskets to be much more widely commercialized. We helped her in touch with a major supermarket chain that operates countrywide. And then she helped women from 8 villages in her region and gave them the skills to start making their own baskets and then helped commercialize. And so now she's part of a very successful operation that's really brought that to scale. And she's supplying baskets from her village and from these other 8 villages. And now they're being sold all over PNG, thanks to that agreement with this big chain. So, I mean, that's an example of the kind of helping young and women entrepreneurs with great business ideas, helping them to take them to scale, using our reach to connect them with further down the value chain and really helping them to take their business to another level.
Bougainville, as far as the government's concerned and many others, expects to be independent within 3 years. Is it going to, in that time, be able to fashion a viable economy so it can survive?
Well, strengthening the economy and revitalizing the economy for Bougainville is going to be absolutely essential to its progress and prosperity, irrespective of the path. And of course, I mean, I can't comment on the future. I can't predict the future. And the process for determining Bougainville's future is in others' hands. But whatever direction that process takes, it's absolutely certain that economic transformation, revitalization is absolutely, on any view, going to be absolutely essential for Bougainville's future progress and prosperity. And the question is, how much help can we give it? How quickly can we catalyze it? And we work very closely with the authorities and the people of Bougainville to realize their aspirations. And those aspirations, whatever they are, will certainly involve economic rejuvenation and transformation.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, Tofa Suifua.